I think pathogens are very fascinating because they usually teach us a lot about the host, whether it's us or the animals we eat. To try to understand the pathogen, you would need to understand its life cycle or how it gets into the host, how it lives there, and whether it makes it ill or not, and so on.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. bioMérieux is a world leader in the field of diagnostics for more than 60 years. From pathogen detection to genomics and data applications, bioMérieux helps poultry manufacturers going beyond the test results.
You can combat mycotoxins in your feed with Fumezyme from DSM Firmenich. Fumezyme is the only FDA-approved enzyme to degrade fumonisins.
AB Vista offers pioneering products and technical services tailored to the poultry industry to help them succeed. Adiseo provides nutritional solutions and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Doug Korver, and I'm one of the hosts of the Poultry Podcast Show. Welcome to our latest installment. If you find this interview interesting, please let us know by visiting our website at wisenetics.com. And you can also learn more about all of our podcast segments, which cover poultry, swine, dairy, feed milling, and pet food. And feel free to suggest a new guest as well, if you would like to. Today, we're joined by Dr. Brian Lassen. Brian is Senior Research Epidemiologist at the Research Group for Foodborne Pathogens and Epidemiology at the National Food Institute at the Technical University of Denmark. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you here. Can you give a bit of a background on yourself and tell us how you arrived at your current position?
Yeah, it's kind of a long journey, I did my master thesis in biochemistry at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, that was my beginning into the path of pathogens, because I was interested in fighting diseases around the world, and had a very rosy picture about how that was going to happen. So, but I ended up in the veterinary faculty doing studies on pigs, actually, and their immunology in the infections with both parasites and bacteria and vaccine studies. But the parasites kind of hooked onto me, and I really fell in love with those. And I continued my PhD, but abroad in Estonia. At the Estonian University of Life Sciences, where I started my career as a researcher. So I started doing epidemiology on coccidia and cattle there, and then moved on to different zoonoses from there. So that kind of became my path towards zoonoses, was that, but it was zoonotic parasites to begin with, and bacteria came on later. And then a few viruses, and then when I moved back to Denmark, where I came from, where I'm coming from, 10 years had passed, and I had done a career there and ended up as a senior researcher there. Then I moved to Denmark, and then were employed at DTU, as we call it, the Danish Technical University, or Technical University of Denmark, it's called. In English translation, at the food science part, where I was asked to look into controlling Campylobacter as my employment there. And since then, I have gotten different projects and worked on that bacteria. And hopefully, I will return to parasites again one day, but currently it's bacteria.
Birds are constantly threatened by the exposure of mycotoxins in their feed. Fumonisins are a highly prevalent mycotoxin that can impact health and performance. DSM Firmenich offers a range of analytical services to assess mycotoxin contamination and solutions to combat mycotoxins. One of those solutions is Fumezyme, the only FDA-approved enzyme to combat fumonisins. Visit dsmfirmenich.com/Fumezyme to learn more.
So most of your work in the past has been with swine and cattle, it sounds like. How did you move into working with poultry?
It was not only cattle and pigs. It was actually wildlife and pets and many kind of animals I was working with. But the reason I'm working with poultry now and has done that for a few years is because Campylobacter is kind of very heavily linked to the poultry and poultry production. So a majority of human cases can be linked to the consumption of broiler meat. And that's why trying to stop that as early in the production, or reduce it at least, is a key issue in controlling the human infections and keeping them as low as possible. So yeah, that's how, you know, it's a major source for the human infection. So that's why we need to try to control it.
So are there some unique challenges working with poultry as opposed to some of the other species that you've worked with, or something that you particularly enjoy working with poultry, or is it the opportunity just to work with the pathogens that excites you?
No, I think pathogens are very fascinating because they usually teach us a lot about the host, whether it's us or the animals we eat. To try to understand the pathogen, you would need to understand its life cycle or how it gets into the host, how it lives there, and whether it makes it ill or not, and so on. So to understand the epidemiology, as it's called, the transmission from host to host, you kind of have to understand the host from the bacteria's perspective, so to say, why it's a good host to have, which makes it the broilers or the chicken fascinating, because for example, for Campylobacter's case, there's some indications that they can get ill from some of the species of Campylobacter, but it's mainly a carrier mostly for the bacteria. So the gut environment of the chicken is interesting in that regard, and trying to understand how when it gets into the broiler into the broiler's life, why at that particular time, what the animal do or do not do to kind of get in contact with it, and these kind of things. So there's everything from behavioral science to diet to gut microbiome, and even the weather. I mean, and the climate change, the climate inside the stables, and these kind of things. All these factors is kind of important for trying to understand both the pathogen and the host interaction. So you really have to take everything at once to kind of.
So learning about the pathogen is really an opening to a whole much bigger world that influences that world. So
it is, and it's fascinating if you keep an open mind and the childish kind of attitude towards learning, then you really can learn a lot very quickly about a production like the poultry production. And it's also in the conversation with the farmers and like what they're doing and what they see and how their concerns are. That's very interesting also to hear, because they are the ones who kind of as the first line of defense. Right. So it was really interesting to hear their thoughts and what they are doing to prevent these things.
So let's talk about Campylobacter a little bit more. So why is it such a big concern in poultry production?
It's a concern in the poultry production because in the end it makes humans ill. If you, of course, the flock has Campylobacter, it's not a guaranteed thing. It's only some flocks who have Campylobacter. So the concern is that it makes people ill, and it actually is in most countries, if not all, the major cause of foodborne gastrointestinal illnesses, and it causes a lot of what we call burden. Mm-hmm. to human. Human lives in that sense, even though it's not a lethal infection, it's an uncomfortable infection if you get it. So it's a lot of people who get infected, and it causes you know disease, but also loss of work and so on. So it's in that sense it's important for the poultry production to limit this. It's very difficult to eradicate, but it's something that can be limited in with different actions. And yeah, so that's why it's important. It's mainly a push from upwards, because it's not really something that it seems to affect the broiler itself. Mm. It's mainly a political decision that this is something we need to do something about and try to limit.
So the immune system of the bird tolerates the presence of the Campylobacter.
To an extent, it's not all species equally of the Campylobacter. There's many kinds of many species of Campylobacter. Some are known to cause this increased the risk of liver cancer and these kind of things. So there's some side effects of having some of these, but it would normally be an egg-laying hen that is more long-lived because the broiler is short-lived and don't really get to develop long-term illnesses because it would be slaughtered and eaten before that.
I'm most familiar with Campylobacter jejuni. Is that the primary cause of human disease, or are there other species as well?
Yeah, there are other species as well. Jejuni is the main one that we are concerned about and is the most frequently found Campylobacter species. We also see something, another species called Campylobacter coli. It's commonly spoken of as more originating from pigs, but we do find it actually quite commonly in poultry as well. And then there's a more rare species that occur, and in rare cases may also cause human illnesses. But it's mainly those two, coli and jejuni, we need to look at and find. Mm-hmm. But it's a very diverse bacteria because it mutates a lot. So the genetic makeup of even of those species is not just, you know, set in stone. It's actually something that is quite dynamic and changing all the time.
Obviously, flocks of chickens can be infected with Campylobacter, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there will be human disease in people that consume those birds. So your approach is a farm-to-fork approach. What do you mean by that?
Our university, we work a lot with the practical implications of what we do as a science. We're very, very laser-focused on what we do at the university is going to be used in real life. And we have developed something called a risk model where we have followed the bacteria from the production to the broiler that you buy in the retail and try to calculate what are the bacteria that are transferred from each step basically from farm to fork. Mm-hmm. And having a model like this, we can then say what happens if we do some intervention, try to stop the bacteria in different steps of the production, in the farm, in the transport to the slaughterhouse, different steps in the slaughterhouse, in the processing and opening of the chicken or cooling of the chicken or packaging of the chicken. Then we can do different things, and that may have a bigger or smaller effect on the reduction of the bacteria. So we've been working on trying to look at this in a holistic perspective, like a whole system. Mm-hmm. where we try to find ways of stopping the bacteria on several of these steps, and trying to, in the hope of that, the accumulative effect of all these interventions would make a significant reduction to human infections, because it's not just one miracle pill that will solve everything. There's a lot of people who's been trying to get to develop such a pill, but it's not really been there. It's not developed yet, like a vaccine or something like that.
Right. So it sounds like it's a one health approach.
Yeah, it's a one health approach. We can call it that. Yeah.
So can you maybe talk about a one health approach just in general, and maybe how your team is applying that to your research?
The one health means that the health of not just the human, but also the animals we eat, the wildlife around us, and even the environment in general, including insects and animals living in the forest, interact with each other in different ways. And this interaction affects our health and also the way we can also, of course, also infect animals. So it can go both ways. This is what we call zoonosis. So when some kind of infection goes both ways, then it's called a zoonosis. And the One Health is looking at this not just from a human doctor perspective, saying you are ill, I give you a pill and then you get treated and then you're on your merry way. We also try to say, you know, what made you ill in the first place, and what made that thing you ate infected in the first place, and what are the different options of that animal, for example, getting this bacteria or parasite or whatever from wildlife, pets, insects, the soil, water. There's many paths that the bacteria can reach a chicken, for example. So we cannot just say we are only focused on the chicken, or we are only focused on the on the human, we need to also take the environment of the chicken into account and see if we can, where do we find the bacteria? Is it in the soil? Is it on the boot of the farmer? Is it in an insect flying around in the stable? And depending on which one it is, we can then say we put up an insect shield, or we don't allow them access outdoors, or we put a disinfectant on the boot or something like that, to kind of think of it from many angles at the same time. So we're all connected is basically the message of One Health.
So, you know, some bacterial species, pathogens are ubiquitous, and they require particular factors in order to proliferate and cause disease. What about Campylobacter? How does it enter the farm? Is it always present, or are there vectors that bring it in? What are your findings?
It's a very good question, and it's a very difficult answer because it's there are many ways, first of all, that we know of, but we do not know that it's one way. So we look a lot on conventional farms versus free-range farms, so either broilers that are kept indoors all their life or have access outdoors, because we see a clear difference in a number of flocks being positive. Usually the conventional ones that are kept indoors are less frequently infected with Campylobacter when they go to the slaughterhouse compared to the free range. And the reason for that, we think, is because they are let outdoors and have a greater exposure to environment. And in this environment, there can be, of course, other animals, and there can be rainfalls, there can be contact with the soil where the bacteria can live. So they have a higher chance of picking up the bacteria from this environment. So access to outdoors is one that we expect to affect the risk of being infected with Campylobacter. We also know there's a seasonal change. So usually around the summer and late summer, at least in Denmark, we have a higher number of flocks who enter the slaughterhouse as positive. What that the reason for this is less known, because it can be everything from the temperature, of course, and rainfalls. It can be insects being more active, flying around, potentially transporting it on their bodies from one farm or one area to another. We also have more migrating birds in this period, and there's more wildlife that has a chance of kind of entering the farm and or on the outdoor plot areas. But hygiene, of course, is also a very important factor, and cleaning between the flocks. So this is something that we are very interested in looking into, and what is being done there, because farms we follow, they are sometimes, even with any change, becoming negative for Campylobacter, and then suddenly they become positive again. Or they do a lot of work to kind of get rid of it and clean and disinfect, but it remains there. So it seems to be very difficult to kind of find out what exactly is the thing that would work for different farms. So sometimes it's probably a multi-factor problem, or different entry points of the bacteria to the farm at the same time. So one thing, doing one thing may not be enough, from our experience.
So the European Union and Denmark in particular have moved away from using growth promoting antibiotics for many years now, and countries around the world are following suit. What are some of the approaches, or are you investigating approaches to control bacterial disease that producers can use? You mentioned sanitation and biosecurity, but are there other things that producers can do?
Yes, I mean, we have, for example, in Denmark, the industry has developed an audit system where they are checking different hygiene barriers and who gets into the farms, and do they have the right equipment set up for keeping these? We have these ante rooms where you have to go through a barrier, change clothes, and so on, get into the farm to even get into the farm to work there. And there's very specific rules about who can go there and which order you have to kind of wash your hands and change clothes and these kind of things. And they check these, plus the way that the farm is kind of built. Do they the feed, for example, the condition of the dry, or keeping the feed dry, or air intakes, are these intact, or We have these barriers, like for example, if you have sand around the outside of the farm, that seems to have some kind of effect on the access of insects to the farm. We don't have a miracle pill that we can kind of recommend. Much of the work I'm currently doing is doing an experiment where we try to test different things that, according to literature, has a promise of reducing Campylobacter in the broilers. Because of course, you know, there's a lot of people who have been doing a lot of research, good research on this, and we've been trying to take some of what we think is the best of the best. And currently testing this in the production environment, not an experimental setup, but actually how it should be working as it's done in the farm, which is usually the issue that when you do an experiment, it works fine in the lab, and then you go to the production environment and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But we try to see if we can get it to work there in the production environment. And we are currently looking into both organic acids, something called biochar, and a product that uses a yeast fermentate, what was the last one? Oat hulls, which is has been tested previously with some effect. So we want to see if we can kind of use these to reduce Campylobacter. And the reason we have chosen those is, first of all, because of evidence, but secondly, we have a growing organic production in Denmark, it's something the consumers they ask for. But they are very restricted in what they allow to use in controlling different pathogens, including Campylobacter, both hygiene-wise and what they can add to the feed. So we've been trying to look for things that could actually be used in this context of these things that seem to have a promise. So
I'm interested in the oat hulls. Is that an effect on fermentation in the hindgut and changing environmental conditions, or is there a binding of the Campylobacter to the oat hulls and they are removed from the digestive tract? Have you looked at the mechanisms?
Well, we believe the mechanism could be that, according to what we've been reading, is that the more coarse diet is causing a slower movement of the bowel and thus a longer exposure to acids, the natural kind of control of the bacteria in the chicken. So we believe that could be one of the reasons. Another explanation could be that, that's been explained in the literature, that could be some other things growing on the hulls that could be having a microbial biome effect, on the chicken. And we actually we've been doing, sequencing of the microbiome of the chicken to look into if it's changing these things we add to the feed to see if some of this effect that we may or may not observe is due to a microbiome changing in the chicken. So we have both a kinetic effect, but it could also be a change in the microbiome due to whatever is on the hulls. I don't think that would be the case in our situation in our case, because we heat treat the pills. It's standard in Denmark that the pills that's the cause of the term salmonella. That the food, the pills that are given to the broilers are treated so to reduce that salmonella can be introduced into farms.
I'd like to remind our audience that if you find this or any of our previous topics worthwhile and informative, please subscribe to our YouTube channel on the Poultry Podcast Show channel. And you can do this by clicking on the bell icon to receive our notifications. You can also share the video if you learned something new today. So, Brian, let's talk about your work in general with disease control and prevention in poultry production. Some of the things you've described make it sound very complicated in terms of understanding who the players are and where things are coming from. So how do you approach that those unknowns?
So you can approach it from many angles, of course. The buyer of the research, in the sense of government or whoever gives the grant, are of course interested in some kind of outcome. It can be, of course, be less people ill, and it can also be that it's a more competitive industry or something like this. But from a curious scientific perspective, we are, of course, trying to look around the corners where nobody else is looking to kind of, because this, there's a lot of people researching Campylobacter and a lot of people doing molecular biology and these kind of things on this to try to kind of find the magic key to understanding how Campylobacter spread, because it mutates a lot and it's hard to find where the source are coming, what's the source of different Campylobacter. So it's kind of interesting to see, for me, it's kind of important to ask why things are not following a pattern. So things, for example, like I mentioned before, is that why is it that some farms that don't do anything become Campylobacter negative as a flock? So they've been positive, 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 and then suddenly they're negative, and then stay negative, and they haven't changed anything. And people who do a lot of work trying to prevent Campylobacter have less effect. And I think it's very interesting to go and study then what is it that could have changed in that particular environment. And sometimes the environment is in our lab when we do tests, and suddenly the bacteria doesn't behave as we expected it to. For example, the way to diagnose whether Campylobacter is present is to test it by putting it on an agar, and then you create colonies, and then you count the colonies, and that's how you figure out the concentration of the Campylobacter. But for example, if you put this on a metal plate to do experiments on it, and then remove it afterwards and try to put it on an agar, and it doesn't grow just after the last drop of water has disappeared from this plate. It's kind of curious, because if it should be that easy to stop it from growing, it should be very easy to control it in the farm. So there might be something we have missed, and then we have to study what happened to that bacteria that just got dry, and then figure out what it is that it is doing. It could be a metabolic thing, for example, that is going on that we have overlooked, and this might be explaining the epidemiology of the bacteria in the farm. So it's kind of to follow the bacteria and follow it, just observe its behavior and appearing and disappearing and reappearing, and then figuring out why did they reappear under these conditions and not other conditions. Was it especially dry or wet summer, or did the farmer suddenly have a new staff coming from somewhere? Or I mean, there can be everything from sociological to behavioral to climate, everything can play in. So it's interesting to ask questions and then go and test them in the lab and figure out what could be the reason.
Sounds like a lot of detective work.
Yeah, it's detective work is kind of the way to describe it, because it's a good way to phrase it, because it's, if something doesn't add up, you can apply the logic, right? You can rule out things like the Sherlock Holmes, you can rule out by deduction. If this is not the reason, then that may be the reason. If that's not the reason, then something else, until you have nothing left but the truth, as Sherlock Holmes would say. Yeah. So you can try to rule out something, and sometimes you end up with a situation where to get the answer of whether something is the reason, you lack a method, and then you need to develop that method. That's what we're kind of doing as scientists. Then it's like, we can't test this because we don't have the tool. And then we had to invent the tool to do that. It might be that, for example, the microbiome. We couldn't look into the chicken before. So the microbiome means that it's, I didn't explain that previously, but it means that the whole makeup of everything inside the intestine, bacteria, fungi, parasites, everything in there, including intestinal, whatever it's eaten, is one big mash of living things that you can kind of make up genetically and try to sort out and quantify. And it's becoming a growing field now, because more and more things can be connected to this microbiome and whatever is present in this, or the makeup of this microbiome. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a new tool that was developed that allowed us to kind of explore new risks, so to say. Like, you know, for example, if I give something to the feed, and it increases some bacteria, like lactic bacteria, it might decrease the Campylobacter, because it makes it a less favorable environment in the gut of the chicken, to our advantage, because we want to reduce Campylobacter. So that's how you can kind of, with the probiotics, kind of can turn up some bacteria and turn down some other bacteria. And this gives us a new tool, how to pursue the bacteria, the control of Campylobacter.
Boehringer Ingelheim develops poultry vaccines of unparalleled quality with a focus on prevention and control across a wide range of diseases. We deliver unique, sustainable solutions for broilers, layers, breeders, and turkeys. Our veterinary network brings unsurpassed knowledge and experience, helping producers make smart, innovative, science-driven decisions to improve bird health and performance. For more information, visit poultryhealthusa.com.
So you mentioned having to either utilize new tools or develop new tools. What are some of the tools that are most important or techniques that are most important in your research? And maybe what are some of the limitations that researchers should keep in mind as they look at bringing on new tools into their research program?
I work with a lot with some of the high-tech stuff, like we do the whole genome sequencing and microbiome things. But I actually really like the low tech the approaches where you really look at what you, when you open a chicken, you look at how it looks like, you take that out of the intestinal contents and you quantify it during the classical methods for finding Campylobacter. You can really learn a lot just from doing that, the classical ones. Just a simple question could be like, you know, we test Campylobacter on these selective plates, but what if we are only taking one colony? We may miss, we won't have the dominant colony on the plate, right? So maybe you should ask a question, am I biasing my, you know, what kind of species is causing the problem by taking just one colony, for example, just simple stuff like that. But we have this molecular stuff we're using to kind of understand where it's coming from. We're trying to find fingerprints for these Campylobacter that we find in the chicken or in the humans and try to connect them, the two dots from the chicken and the humans, and say, is the chicken actually the cause of the human infection, or is it from somewhere else, from bathing somewhere or eating another thing or traveling or whatever? So that's how we can kind of quantify how much of a problem broiler production or another production could be. But there's the problem with Campylobacter is that it's mutating so much. So it's very difficult to actually make this fingerprint. It's a changing fingerprint all the time. So it's very difficult to do this tracing. So the dream is to use this sequencing for surveillance of Campylobacter and other pathogens. But it's a lot of data. And it's very, first of all, currently very costly, and it's very to some extent laborsome to do this kind of analysis, and the information you have to get out of it requires a lot of data handling to make sense of, especially something that is changing so rapidly as Campylobacter. So we currently are on the verge of developing the tools again for kind of making sense of all of this chaos. So it's not not a magic pill for finding out what is causing the problems with Campylobacter, but it's a tool for increasing the understanding. So you shouldn't be blinded if you ask the question whether we should be having concerns about the limitations. And I think the limitation is that you shouldn't be blinded by these tools. We still have to be aware about the limitations of what we can actually deduct from those kind of data. At this point, it might be much better in the near future, artificial intelligence and other things, right?
Good advice for researchers. So your background was initially in parasitology. So do you think that background gives you a unique perspective or insight on understanding bacterial pathogens?
Yes, I hope so. I think that, parasites, it's kind of a love relationship to parasites, because they're really, really fascinating creatures. They are, because the whole idea with parasites is that they are living on us or with us without us mainly knowing most of the time, because they're basically adapted as well as any organism can to us. So this are running under the radar in our immune system or getting infected by something taught me at least a lot about what is the ideal situation for a pathogen. The ideal situation for a pathogen is not necessarily to make you ill. It should be like subclinical symptoms or something milder that allows it to multiply and spread, because that's the ultimate goal of most pathogens, like any other living thing, is to multiply and spread. So that would be a successful pathogen. So with that mindset, looking at a new pathogen like Campylobacter, it's like, what is the strategy that Campylobacter is using that is so unique, that makes it so successful that we are thinking of it as a primary problem for foodborne illnesses? And I mentioned the mutation rate, for example, for Campylobacter before, that it's so fast-paced, look viewed with a human eye, that it's difficult to catch, basically, right? It's changing so much. So this is a survival strategy, probably, from the Campylobacter, is that it's changing its genetic makeup, making it difficult from an immunological perspective to get rid of or get immunity towards. But from our perspective, it's difficult for us to kind of, you know, control it and prevent it, because we cannot exactly figure out where it's coming from all the time. It might change, so it looks like it's changing its direction. So I think that kind of mindset from parasitology is like trying to understand the host and where it's getting its advantage on the host. It's the Achilles heel or something like that on the host is kind of, I think that's something parasitology taught me, rather than just looking at it as a single cell organism that needs to be eradicated with a hammer or something. It's kind of a love relationship, I think. You have to kind of love the organism and try to understand its purpose from its perspective. I think that's fun, the most fun way to deal with them.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Boehringer Ingelheim. Health experts bring industry-leading knowledge and expertise to today's poultry producers to help them solve challenging health issues through smart, science-driven decision-making using the best resources available. Probiotech International. Creating the next generation of feed and water additives to improve animal nutrition, health, and well-being. Innovation is in our nature. Visit probiotech.com/EN for more information. Natural Biologics is looking deeper to find the natural solutions to your poultry health challenges. Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition, your partner for extra animal performance. Join the Poultry Science Association at our inaugural PSA Pacific Rim Scientific Conference, October 13th through 16th in Macau, China. Explore groundbreaking symposia and hear the latest research impacting the global poultry industry. Here is your chance to present your latest work, recruit future leaders, and network with other experts in the field. Help us shape the future of poultry science. Register now at poultryscience.org. See you in Macau.
Are there any topics that we haven't covered that you'd like me to ask you about or that you'd like to discuss?
I think one thing was for Campylobacter that's interesting. We just went through the COVID time. We're still here, but it's the big impact is hopefully behind us. But it was quite interesting because I'm sitting with... part of my work is also to look at the monitoring of zoonoses in Denmark, collect the data for these kind of things and report them. And of course, we are discussing the trends and how things have developed. And it's been very interesting to follow also the foodborne illnesses, because, of course, production produces food for us because we need the food. But the way we got ill from it changed in the number of cases and so on. So it's been very interesting to follow what was the change from, is it from traveling, to the restriction from traveling, or is it because we didn't go and grill so much? We didn't have the social events of going grilling in the summer or something like that. And it's very interesting to kind of get a unique view into behavior through that COVID impact. I think that's just also interesting because I think it's also allows you to do more of this detective work of how we eat our food and how we handle it, basically. Import-export is also affected by these things. So this is very interesting to kind of think of how our production suddenly changes with another disease, in this case, a war or a shortage of resources or something.
Well, and of course, there was a devastating impact of COVID, but it did allow for some, as you said, unique opportunities to look at, society-wide changes in people's behavior that maybe wouldn't have created an opportunity, or you wouldn't been able to create that opportunity artificially. So
we also had now that we have in Europe, we have the war in Ukraine, for example, which affects a lot of the things that normally would be exported to Europe from Ukraine. And this includes feed, and it includes other productions that the animal food production uses, which I have observed also requires them to make different changes in where they get their source material, there's food and other things, bedding materials and so on, from different sources, which means that, again, the ecological situation can change by a geopolitical situation like that. So even if you just turn down the temperature to save some energy because of gas prices or something like that, can again affect, how well a bacteria survives in the farm and so on. So I think it's very interesting to kind of see again the detective work, how the bigger picture is also kind of affecting the local situation in a farm, for example.
And somehow subtle changes might have effects that we wouldn't anticipate.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's very fascinating how this is again the One Health, how everything is connected, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Brian, for your time. Again, our audience, we spoke with Dr. Brian Lassen from Technical University of Denmark. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a thumbs up on the platform you're using to view the interview. I'm Doug Korver, and I'll see you next time on the Poultry Podcast Show.
Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.